From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Poker is a sport, so is chess, and so is competitive gaming. Esports is, in fact, booming. Market watchers predict revenues to hit $1.5 billion by 2020. We recently spoke to folks from UGA's esports team, and Georgia high schools got the green light to form student sports teams last year. As the definition of athletes expands, so do demands to treat gaming-related injuries. Dr. Vonda Wright is an orthopedic surgeon in Atlanta, currently working with game developer Skillshot Media to research and treat professional gamers. Dr. Wright, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you've been in orthopedics and sports medicine for a long time.
20 years.
Research and practice in a lot of women's health, aging, musculoskeletal.
Thank you very much. It's all out there.
When did you plunge into esports?
Well, you know what? I have to be honest with you. For a long time, being a doctor who believes that mobility is medicine and all the great research that's coming out that sitting will kill us, for a really long time, I wasn't a fan of esports. And I would say, look at our children. 30% of them are obese, 17% have diabetes. But the more I looked into it, and I thought about what the definition of athlete is. You know, we're playing towards a goal. We're doing it in groups. We're winning something. It's not so dissimilar from anything that we traditionally think of. And when I did a deeper dive and I saw that these kids have very short careers, 5 to 7 years, and some of them, the world-class ones, athletes, I hesitated to say it, but you know what? That's what I've come to really, truly believe. They are leaving their games with devastating, life-changing injuries the same way you see on a football field or a gymnastics mat. So I thought, as an orthopedic surgeon and someone who likes to think ahead of my time, how am I going to get in front of this and really treat these young athletes like the athletes they are?
So do you find people kind of cocking their eyebrow and saying, Oh, they're athletes?
Yes. You know what? And in the same way that I did for years, that is still the response. But the fact is, people who are really looking ahead and smart, and even people who really care about taking care of athletes, will want to take care of the neck injuries that these kids are getting, to take care of the shoulder and elbow and hand, to not let 6 of the top gamers in the world get blood clots in their legs, which can be devastating. So we really need to take all the amazing things we've learned for sports performance and transfer them to another group of athletes. And I am really interested in it now. And I think we have to do this. It's the right thing to do.
So what are you doing? You are working on preventative or treatment, both of those?
So we know that in traditional athletes, there are things we can do to not only help them with performance, but prevent injury. We screen for injury. We look for limitations in joint mobility and in limitations of muscle flexibility. We look at overuse patterns. We look at nutrition, sports nutrition, sleep and rest cycles, and we do it really, really well. You know, we know how to create champions by squeezing performance out. What's amazing about esports athletes is that none of this has been done before. Now, you think that esports are just a bunch of kids sitting around in the basement playing video games.
For many, many hours and ordering pizza.
Yes, but I'm telling you, when you really learn about it, there are single person games. But there are team games, games where you have 4 guys and gals. It's another thing I love about esports, playing together with one substitute. Well, that pretty much sounds like a team, right? And they're playing for long hours and they get overuse injuries. And so we are screening them for injury. We are doing fitness and endurance exercise. You know, some of them are already fitness people. Many of them are sitters. So we know from our literature that the stronger our body is, the stronger our brains are, and we're going to harness that knowledge for them.
Yeah, I was going to ask, are they mostly physical injury? I mean, I often think of it as a mental thing. I would not say that I'm one of those people who thinks, oh, gamers, they're just, what I mean? But it is a mental test.
It's both, right? So they play staring at a screen for very long periods of time. So there's mental fatigue. There's eye fatigue. But also, you know, there are many platforms to play games. Some of them, such as Twitch, is a different mechanism than just a keyboard and a mouse. But for instance, depending on how you hold your mouse, it's the same for us at any desk we sit at. We either make ourselves prone to carpal tunnel syndrome or we're not. And as I observe these gamers, some of them palm their mouse, which is much safer than clawing their mouths. So you can imagine hands in a claw, hands flat. And so as we identify movement patterns, part of what we're doing is researching who gets hurt and why, because it's never been done before. And that's also what's so fascinating to me.
Because you're on the forefront of
this. We're on the forefront of it. Yeah. We get to predict injury and train it out of them in the same way that we're doing it in traditional athletes. But maybe the thing that I love most about learning about gaming is, remember how we just said it's a bunch of kids sitting in a basement, not talking to anybody, being maybe social outcasts. Now, since Georgia High School has designated gaming as a varsity sport, every school in Forsyth County has a gaming team. And when they went to states and one of the high schools got second in states, those kids who were previously isolated became the school heroes. Mm. And so now you raise up an entire new generation of people to celebrate. And when these kids go to college to play their sport, which now there's 31 colleges that give full rides, they come out as computer programmers and IT people and tech people. So it's just very positive all around, from social to societal to let's help some kids get more fit.
Dr. Vonda Wright is an orthopedic surgeon, and she's also a sports medicine expert, has been working for a long time in both practice and also in research of sports medicine. We're talking about esports and esports athletes getting injuries, how to prevent and how to treat. And you've been working with Hi-Res Studios and Alpharetta and Skillshot Media. They develop games. So tell me about this collaboration.
Yes.
And is this feeding you with players? I mean, how does this work?
So you know what? For the first time in Georgia, players have come to the studios in Alpharetta, 90 of them from around the world, on multiple teams playing a game called Smite and a game called Paladins, where in Smite you get to be a god. You know, you get to choose the god you
are. Who doesn't like that?
I know, who doesn't want to be that? So teams of four with one substitute and 90 from across the world. So we formed this partnership with Todd Harris, their visionary leader.
They're in Atlanta.
They're in Alpharetta, right in our backyard, actually. So I said to him, hey, let's treat your guys like the traditional athletes we always do. And he was so into it because he recognizes that these kids, by definition, are doing everything traditionals do. So we had one screening where lots of the athletes came in and we looked for injury patterns, just like I told you. What's weak? What's strong? What needs improvement? We talked to them about their injury history, same thing we do with traditional athletes. We're going to have another screening at the end of the month. And then one of the things we've committed to them is my own athletic trainer that I work with every day in my clinic is actually also a strength and conditioning coach. So once a week, we've decided he'll go. And just like we lead community outreach fitness programs, we do a couple times a week in Forsyth, he's going once a week and really teaching them how to prevent injury and get stronger. And I'm really excited to see what we're going to get these kids to, because probably the majority have really been sitting in a chair doing this game and could benefit from the stamina that we're going to provide them in a fitness.
And this is there's a lot of money at stake here for these professional players, isn't there?
Well, you know what? In the same way that other traditional athletes make a lot of money, these kids can too. You know, last year there was a huge competition here in Atlanta called DreamHack, and the prize money was over $1 million, which blows people's minds when you think that the winner of the Boston Marathon only gets six figures, not seven figures, right? And now we're not to the place like pro baseball where it's $132 million for 13 years, but you wait. I mean, I believe it's going to happen, and I made the bold prediction in a group of athletic trainers, and it got a bunch of groans, that when gaming truly kicks off as a sport, coupled with our fascination with virtual reality, which currently is possible to stick you and I, can you imagine, into a game? Maybe football as we know it will disappear, and it will become more of a virtual thing. I mean, I know, isn't that weird?
It is weird.
I predicted, and maybe 15 or 20 years, we're going to weigh physical injury versus virtual. And then if you and I get to actually stand next to one of the quarterbacks, and well, who wouldn't want to be in that game? And maybe we'll have to stop playing physical games. Not that I'm advocating that.
If they can get me to do a virtual workout, I'll be really, really happy.
Let's be clear about this, audience. I'm not advocating that we stop moving, but I think technology is going to drive the future of sports.
Well, I mean, look, we look back at gladiatorial sports and think, how could they have done that? That was just barbaric. But now we're looking at a whole other thing. Mm-hmm. But is it for, I mean, if you look at these games, there are announcers with their headsets, there are cheering crowds, there are big screens, there are timers. It is a sports event. But like professional athletes, they can be reluctant to talk about their injuries because they might get benched. Does that happen here?
Of course. There's a lot of hiding of injury. There's gutting it through. You know, it's not easy to substitute an e-sport athlete during a game. I mean, somebody's got to sit down in the chair, get up from the chair, and then the game goes on. So I think that some of the same issues that we deal with in traditional athletes, we will in esports. One of the things I really want to affect in esports is the way they eat.
Mm-hmm.
So I've observed many places that we think sugar is great for the brain. And while glucose is the fuel of the brain, a wall of candy and empty calories is not the way to optimize performance. So, you know, getting these kids into a grocery store and helping them make smart food choices, we call it performance foods, is another aspect of this.
Is there any data yet on how many people are injured or how many injuries happen in this field?
You know, the good and bad of it is when we did a lit review to look for what's out there, we found two case studies. Now, to put that in perspective, something very common now like hip arthroscopy or ACL surgery has millions of citations. So that gives us the opportunity to really find out and publish what people need to look out for. Now, I have a little bit of inkling of what we're going to see because, you know, I'm an orthopedic surgeon. I'm an arthroscopist, which means I am looking at a screen all day, holding instruments in my hand. And the things that arthroscopic surgeons retire because of are some of the same things that these gamers experience, like neck arthritis.
Because you're hunched over all the time.
Our hands are playing our
game.
And
how about thumbs? Thumbs must get a lot of action.
It depends on the platform they're playing, especially if it's a joystick or a game console where you're actually doing the action with your thumbs. You know, there's actually something called phone and gamer's thumb that hand surgeons have to deal with. So it has to do with the joints becoming arthritic and worn out from overuse or the tendons that flow over the thumb joints. So, I mean, you're right on with what can happen.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the other things we're teaching is how to stretch out the tendons on the palm side of the hand because their hands are always in a palm down position. And so those muscles get really tight and the ones on the top get weak. And so just reversing, it's like sitting, you know, sitting all day will make your rear end and your core really weak. So reversing those motion patterns. And so that's something also we're teaching them. I've introduced, can you play these games standing, like standing desks?
Standing desks.
Can you do it sitting on an exercise ball? Mm-hmm. And they've told me that that's just way too distracting. But thinking through these options of injury prevention so that we don't get to the place where some of the best South Korean players in the world have had career-ending tendon pain that they just can't continue at a very young age. And we're going to try to prevent that.
So you told us that you've turned around in your vision of esports as athletics.
Mm-hmm.
Do you play games yourself?
I do arthroscopy several times a week. Which is not a game.
I'm not sure that
counts.
It's
not a game. But I'm hoping that the Smite players will teach me how, because I've got my eye on a certain goddess that I want to be.
That's so good. Vonda Wright, you are on the forefront. Thank you so much for telling us about it.
Thank you for having me.
Vonda Wright, she's an Atlanta-based orthopedic surgeon and sports medicine expert, and she's partnering right now with a game developer to both diagnose, treat, and prevent injuries for esports athletes. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Before Atari, Nintendo, and PlayStation, there was Fairchild Channel F.
Channel F, the one with all the fun. The Fairchild Video Entertainment System at your larger JCPenney. The home entertainment system that never gets old. Plug in a new video card and change the fun.
That 1976 ad heralded an innovation that changed the gaming industry forever. Interchangeable cartridges for consumer gaming consoles. It was a literal game changer, and it was the brainchild of Jerry Lawson, one of few African-American engineers working in Silicon Valley. He died in 2011. Now his children are honoring his legacy with the Lawson Foundation for Diversity in Technology. Anderson Lawson is with me in the studio. He brought his 3D glasses for a new game that he's working on. Anderson,
Jason, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Karen Lawson is also with us. She joins us on the line from Washington, D.C. Hello, Karen.
Hello, Virginia. How are you?
Very well, and really happy to hear this story. It is one that I think is not so often told. And that ad, of course, it did not really deliver on its message.
Not at all.
That they would never, this would be like this forever. But the Fairchild was a big deal. What was it, Anderson?
So the Fairchild Channel F was the first electronically programmed video game system to have cartridges.
So what did that mean for the future of electronic games?
It separates the media from the actual console. So mm-hmm. now you can have, an infinite number of games in your library.
So by today's standards, it wasn't terribly sophisticated, but it did allow so much. Karen, what do you know about your dad's inspiration for creating the console and the cartridge?
Well, actually, he was a tinkerer, and he had set up and created a game, arcade game, in our garage, which was the lab, called Demolition Derby. And so the bosses at Fairchild got wind of what he was doing and asked him to head the engineering division in the team that created the Fairchild Channel F.
Mm-hmm. And apparently it was so novel that every cartridge he produced had to be produced, approved by the FCC. They'd never seen anything like it. And he was inspired as a kid by George Washington Carver. How did he turn that into what became electronic gaming? Who wants to pick that up, Karen or Anderson?
Karen, go ahead.
Anderson. Okay. he was in the first grade, and he had a teacher named Mrs. Gruber. And he was in a classroom where he was one of few, if not the only, African-American student there. And his teacher felt that it was important for him to have a person that looked like him that he could look up to and aspire to be. So that was kind of the seed that planted in him that he could pretty much do anything that he wanted to do. So it led him down the road to becoming an inventor and an engineer.
Now, you were both little kids when he helped really revolutionize the industry. That cartridge went on to be used by other console manufacturers, the Atari 2600, big, big, big deal. Did you both grow up playing games, Anderson?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, actually, we did. He actually utilized us to do some of the QA testing.
Oh, you were the first beta testers?
Yeah, so to
That's
speak.
That's right.
Yeah.
So what was it like having a dad who could create fun for you?
It's interesting. A lot of people would think we grew up playing games all the time. You know, we did play it, games a lot. Friends would come over. However, interesting thing is that as we grew older, my father actually balked at the idea of playing games all day.
Huh.
And the reason why I'm in technology at all now is because of one incident that happened when I might have been 11 or 12 years old.
Yeah. What happened?
My cousin and I were playing games, and I guess he had gotten tired of it. It was summertime, and he said, you know what, if you guys want to play games so much, how about you learn how to create them?
Hmm.
And he took a book, and he went into the garage and came back with this book. It was 101 basic video games, and he just tossed it on the table in front of us, said, you're going to turn off these games, and here's a computer, and there was a portable IBM that he had. And figure it out. And we learned how to program games. So.
And you've continued in that vein.
Yeah, continued in that vein for, my entire life.
Well, so this was, a gaming industry pioneer. The first game cartridge went on to start his own company, VideoSoft. But I have to say, his name may not be as well known as other big game pioneers. Karen, why do you think that is?
There's a space for everyone in the industry, but maybe because the Fairchild Channel F didn't take off in terms of popularity and widespread popularity,
mm-hmm.
I think that is why people don't know about Gerald A. Lawson. So I think it's more attached to the popularity of the game, perhaps, and then really the Atari being what it was and what it turned out to be just a year later. I think that might have dwarfed the Channel F innovation that Dad was a part of.
But it looked like you were going to say something, Anderson. Do you think that's true?
Yeah. I was just going to say also that oftentimes when, you know, when people kind of the first to do something, you don't really hear who they are, right? You know, my dad used to joke, it might be politically incorrect, but he would say, you know, the guy that is pioneering the effort is also the person with all the arrows in his back, right? So you might not know anything about him, right? But, you know, which is fine. You know, I think that it's, you know, now, you know, word about his story is getting out there. So, right.
Well, you both grew up in Silicon Valley. What was that experience like for you? I mean, you were in school with people who, a predominantly white community. What was that like? People who didn't really look like you.
You know, it's funny. That's my baseline, right? So I couldn't tell you from a child's perspective what it's like to grow up with a bunch of people. Well, you know, I have family in New York City, right? So I had that experience, right, in Brooklyn. But I didn't really look at it as a big challenge.
It was just natural?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think as I got older into my teens, then it was like, you know what, you know, I want to get an education around people look like me. And that's what led me to go to Morehouse College and come to Atlanta. And, you know,
how about for you, Karen?
Well, it was interesting for me because I kind of wrestled sometimes with stereotypes. People didn't really know what to make of me. Almost like, you know, oh, you might be here at the school, but you may not come from a middle-class socioeconomic background. There were labels that were put on me because of the fact that I'm African-American. Mm-hmm. And those were things that, you know, you really kind of have to fight through and challenge and kind of open up people's eyes and perspectives on the infinite possibilities of people. So it was a challenge for me sometimes, but it was just the way it was. You know, we did, like Mark said, we went to New York a lot. We did have, you know, African American friends in our neighborhood, but most of the time we were in environments where we might have been the only ones in our classrooms. And so we're hoping that, or I hoped that that would lead to something, you know, better. And
if you don't mind me picking that up, because this is what you're doing now, Karen Anderson, Karen Lawson there. Anderson Lawson is also with us, her brother and sister. Their father, Jerry Lawson, known for his work in designing the Fairchild Channel F video game console. He's really the guy who pioneered the commercial video game cartridge. Now his children are both working to help diversify the industry. Because look at players. I mean, African Americans, second largest ethnic group to play video games. This is after Asian Americans. An International Game Developers Association study found that only 2% of developers, however, are African American. Anderson, why do you think such a lack of representation among developers?
I think oftentimes it's just exposure and
So if you don't see anybody in your family or community who's doing it, don't do it?
Yeah, that. And also, I think that a lot of schools that people attend when, you know, elementary, middle and high school don't have like STEM programs set up to kind of push that agenda. Mm-hmm. And it may not just be looked at as interesting. But if if that agenda is kind of pushed and people can understand different careers that they can get into, I think you'll see an increase in those numbers.
Well, I know that your foundation is now partnering with New York City Public Schools to increase diversity in STEM fields. How do you do that? What are you doing?
Workshops, exposure. We recently did a talk at Cornell University in New York to a workshop for kids to show them how video games are made. There was demos with robots, a whole bunch of different areas of technology just to get people exposed and excited about technology.
So why did you all decide to go beyond just game development and look at STEM education?
Well, you know what? My father's always been into that in particular, it wasn't just games. You know, and often if you look him up, you might find him saying, you know, if his idea on games were they should be something to that should be teaching you something. You should leave your game, you know, with something of value, right? And you know, just shooting things randomly to him was kind of crazy. And he wanted people to kind of open up the system and figure out how it worked, because he's an engineer at heart.
So what does it mean to be a player who is continually taking on the sort of personality and point of view of somebody who doesn't look like you? I mean, there are very few Black or people of color characters, right?
Right.
Gaming,
yeah,
too.
Yeah. So there's it's not very often that you play a game and the protagonist is a African American, mm-hmm, or a female. And if it's a female, it's going to be one that's scantily clad, right? So excite the player.
Right.
So yeah, it is important to have representation in developing these games, right? So that we can, you know, put forth, you know, more positive type images when it comes to the protagonist in the game.
Well, you hit upon the women. Women make up only 14% of people working in the industry. Oftentimes, these female characters, they're pretty narrow, mm-hmm, images of women. You know, like, look at Lara Croft, you know, maybe the woman of computer gaming. Fantastically fit, curvaceous. She and women in WWE wrestling games and Grand Theft Auto criticized for revealing clothing. Karen, what's your idea of a successful, positive lead female character in the games?
You know, I would like to just see gamers be able to create whoever they want to be in a game as far as a female lead. That could be anything or anyone. When I look at that and I look at, you know, inclusion and diversity, I look at the whole spectrum of what could be, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when I see and I think about inclusion, I think about validation, okay? So in order for, you know, me to feel that I'm a part of the group, I have to be able to have the power to create what I'd like to, what I view as a strong woman, or with blue hair or an afro, or, you know, however I want to dress her. So I think it's in the power of having the ability to create what
to be the maker.
Absolutely.
Right. Well, so now you're bringing that program. You've been working with New York City Public Schools. Now you're working with Atlanta Public Schools. I'm curious about the kind of things you're hearing from students. I mean, Anderson, you followed in your father's footsteps. You have an engineering background. You're developing a game. Ghost City 3D is going to be the Apple Store app. Do you think it's harder for people of color who have not seen anybody like your father doing this enter the business? Is there a lack of interest? I mean, what are you hearing from the students? Do they want to do this work?
Yeah, I think when, you know, I spoke earlier about exposure.
Yeah.
So when we did the workshop about a month ago in New York, and people got to see the process and how it works, they got excited. And there was a couple of young teenage boys that approached me and was like, wow, I didn't know it worked that way. And it seems like something I'd like to do. And right. So it sparked an interest. Right. And then to see, you know, to hear my father's story, and there was posters of him up, it kind of, you know, made me think about that poster of, you know, George Washington Carver that my father got to see when, mm-hmm, he was a child. Right. That's what, you know, we should be doing, is inspiring, right? So that the next generation can, you know, want to do something better.
We just heard from Vonda Wright talking about in schools in Forsyth County, now that they have teams, these kids who might have been players or gamers are elevated and they go on often to programming. Have you seen that path? You know, there's not always a clear, like, on-ramp as a player to get into programming. What is it going to take inside of schools to make that happen?
I think that really there are programs out there that help educate children on how the process of software development. And I think that that's really probably the key, is from a basic level, just having an understanding of how it works, and having people in the industry come out and talk to them, mm-hmm. right? It's a little, you know, you could have a course on something, but when you actually see the day-to-day of what it takes to actually be a developer, that will kind of help, I think, keep the interest in it. And
Karen, we have just 30 seconds left, but I wanted to ask you, was this something that your father thought of? I mean, he's you kids are carrying on this legacy and creating diversity. Was this a push for him?
Absolutely. I mean, again, inclusion is important when you're talking about anything, because you really want to have a full picture, a full spectrum of possibilities. So when you are not including all in what you're doing, then you're really kind of limiting yourself on what stories could be told and what could be done to get to the next step.
Well, Karen Lawson, I'm so afraid we have to leave it there. Thank you so much for being with us.
Yes.
And Anderson Lawson, thank you.
Thank you.
They are founders of the Lawson Foundation for Diversity in Technology. We're leaving you with Super Mario's theme song. National Gaming Anthem, maybe? Thank you.
Thank you.
From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Writer and director Lulu Wong found a fascinating family story for her second film. It was from her own family. The Farewell follows a Chinese family's decision not to tell their beloved matriarch that she's been diagnosed with terminal lung cancer. Their complicity in the secret reveals truths about their relationships to one another. The comedian Awkwafina plays the main character, Billy, who resists their decision to shield her grandmother from the truth. If the story sounds familiar, Lulu did tell it herself in an episode of This American Life. The Farewell kicked off the Atlanta Film Festival, which runs through April 14th, and Lulu Wong is joining me in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. This really happened.
It did, yes.
How and when did you find out that your grandmother was dying?
It was in 2013. I was actually in post-production on my first feature when this happened. And my first film was a screwball romantic comedy. And then this happened in my real life. And I thought, this is a real screwball setup. And I was really sad, but it was also just really ridiculous.
And when did you decide that you wanted to tell it? At first, you did it for This American Life.
Yeah. As I was going through it, I think that I started to have this notion of I need to share this with people, even if it's just with friends, because the story and some of the situations I was in felt so insane. I didn't know how to make it as a film, you know, frankly, because I wanted to keep the casting authentic. I wanted to do part of it in Chinese language. But yet I wanted to make it as an American film, as an American story. So I had a hard time getting it set up initially. And it wasn't until I did the story with This American Life that I was finally able to find the right producers.
And I remember that because you taped a lot of the conversations, audio of phone calls that you had with your parents or real life situations. And there's this elaborate ruse that your family comes up with, really, telling Nai Nai, your grandmother, that everybody's avoiding telling her that she's expected to live at that time only a couple of months. This is also, of course, the central tension of the film. Mm-hmm. And Billy is set up as the outsider in a way in this conversation. She wants to tell the truth. It's something you dealt with yourself. Here is an excerpt from your story with This American Life when you're talking with your mom about this dilemma.
I'm pretty sure a lot of other Americans would feel the way that I felt, that somebody's going to die. It's their right to know.
Yeah, but we just think that's not your business. You not live with her, and so.
Okay, but do you understand where I was coming from? Do you understand why I was conflicted?
Yeah, I know, but that's China. That's a different world.
So we find out, I think that Nai Nai, if I'm remembering right, she didn't tell her own husband.
Exactly.
That he was dying when he was dying. I'm sorry to laugh, but it is just so insane in a way. So help us understand what sounds like a pretty deep cultural divide about that awareness of death in Chinese and American culture.
Yeah, and I'm not sure how much of it is just so deeply ingrained. There's obviously all of these philosophical reasons to back why they make this decision, but I've come to learn that so many people do it, that it also is just, in a way, an unspoken, like an obvious truth to the culture. And it wasn't in a way until I started questioning why they were doing it that they had to even reflect on why do we do this. And they dug really deep, and, you know, different people in the family told me different things, and it all makes sense from their point of view. But it definitely is just interesting, the assumptions that we make, that we carry over through history, through culture, through rituals and traditions. And sometimes we think about them and sometimes we don't.
And all of those things just come so clear in the movie, you know, the rituals and traditions. So you set up this idea that everybody's going to come to your cousin's wedding in China. This is their excuse for all coming together to see Nai Nai, basically. But okay, so This American Life, they rigidly fact check, mm-hmm. right? Because they want to make sure that stories are true. But for you, you're writing your own screenplay. You could tell any kind of story here. Mm-hmm. Was there any part that you thought, I'm going to do this differently than it happened in real life?
You know, making a film is such a different beast than doing a fact-based story. And I think in some ways it's even more challenging, because when people know it's journalism, when it's fact-based, it's easy for them to believe that this is true, and immediately they're engaged. But with a movie, people just think of Hollywood, they think of actors, they think of this facade. And so even if you are depicting things that are real, there's a level of skepticism that audiences bring. And then when you do add actors and not real locations like sets and things like that, the danger can be that it contributes to this sense of disbelief.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
really happening.
I can imagine a pitch here. So there's this family. They're not telling their, you know, it almost sounds like, I don't know, an old sitcom or something like
exactly.
that.
Exactly. And yeah. How do you make it still feel really grounded and feel believable? I mean, we open the film with a line that says that it's based on an actual lie. But people who have seen the film, even having seen that line, by the time they get to the end, still don't, they forget that this is a real story. And so it was definitely challenging to, you know, figure out what are the moments and the pieces that I wanted to stay true to in a factual way, and what are the ways that I could depict the truth even better by not sticking to facts.
One of the truths is that your relationship with your grandmother is really close.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you set up that bond with Billy and Nai Nai right from the get-go. They have these long phone conversations. How do you put that kind of dynamic into a script?
Well, you know, I think that I put a lot of consideration into that, because I do think that it's important for people to know that two people can have this kind of a bond, even if they're not seeing each other all the time, even if they're of two different generations. And I think the sort of banter between the two people was really important to me, and keeping the authenticity of that dialogue. Mm-hmm. To capture this relationship that isn't always perfect. It isn't what you think about a grandma who just bakes you cookies and all of that.
She's really open with you.
Yes.
She's really direct with you.
She's open with everyone. You know, that's the kind of, she's a person that she is. So, and there's a lot of humor in that, because you realize, oh, she's not just somebody's grandmother, somebody's mother, but she's a woman, and she at one time was a young woman and had loves of her own and dreams of her own and disappointments of her own. So I wanted to make sure that was captured.
How did you help develop that bond between Awkwafina, who plays the character Billy, which is essentially you, and Shuzhen Zhao, who plays Nai Nai in the film?
The bond between Awkwafina and Zhao was immediate, because Awkwafina was raised by her Chinese grandmother, and Zhao has grandchildren of her own. And so it's so easy to just bring that level of love and project it into this other person who you know is somebody else's granddaughter and somebody else's grandmother. And in many ways, Billy is everybody's granddaughter and Zhao is everybody's grandmother. And when I was casting, that's what I was looking for, was both the specificity of somebody who could play my grandmother's, you know, who has very specific traits, but was also someone who felt universal to everybody and how they see their grandmother.
That is Lulu Wang. She's writer and director of The Farewell. It's one of the films featured, in fact, opened the Atlanta Film Festival, and the festival is running through April 14th. And Awkwafina, as she mentioned, is starring in the film. She is best known as a comedian, so why put her in this pretty dramatic role?
Well, she sent in a self-tape. She said, you know, I really want to do this role, and I know that my resume doesn't say that I'm the most obvious person, but when she sent in that self-tape, I knew immediately that she was the one. There was just no facade there. She felt like the character.
Well, The Farewell also deals with complicated feelings of leaving home mm-hmm. and then returning to home. That isn't quite the same for Billy, the character, and for her parents, certainly, and her uncles and extended family. How does Billy handle going back to China after being in the U.S. for so long?
Yeah, I think Billy has a hard time. And I relate to this, of course, but I think many people who are immigrants, regardless of what age they came over to the U.S. at, there's a sense that you know, you're missing something. But then you go back and you also realize, wait, actually, I don't fit in here anymore. Mm. And so that's what she learns quickly, is that even though the love is there and the bond is there, she starts to see how different she is. You know, we see fish out of water stories all the time, and that's often represented by how people appear physically. If you're blonde and blue-eyed in an Asian country, it's quite obvious you're a fish out of water. But what does it feel like when you actually look like everyone and everyone expects you to be like them and you're not? And all of the expectations that also go along with it, you know, because the main reason her parents immigrated is to give her a better life. And if you are at a stage of your life where you're questioning whether or not you are successful and you're doing all the things that you should be doing, or you feel that you're somehow a disappointment, she's bringing all of that baggage as well back to China, where she wants her grandma to be proud of her and to feel that the sacrifice of her leaving and them not spending their lives together was worthwhile. Yeah. And the truth is, she doesn't know that that's true.
Yeah, that I think is one of the great hanging things in the film. And you know, the uncles and parents, they feel guilty mm-hmm. about having left China for Japan, in this case in the United States. But also really grapples with a lot of emotional responses to grief and how personalities and cultural expectations play into grieving. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a question here of, like, is there a right way to grieve? Because everybody's got their own way. Mm-hmm. And is that what we're getting at, that there is no right way?
Yeah, absolutely. And part of that is cultural. I think that culture and gender and, you know, all apply to how you grieve or how you feel you're expected to grieve versus your own personality. And certainly, I think that if there's an expectation that you have to grieve in a very public way, but you tend to be very private, or certain cultures expect stoicism, whereas other cultures expect the opposite of that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Rending the garments. In fact, I think I remember from the This American Life story that people get hired to be mourners at mm-hmm, funerals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's in the movie as well, a little bit of that. But yeah, and so I think that trying to balance the expectation from your family of how you should be grieving, when also you're not supposed to be grieving because this is a secret, and then wanting to grieve and not being allowed to grieve. And so, yeah, all of those tricky things are what is the underlying tension for Billy.
Well, I think that's what makes it sort of, you know, comic and tragic in many different places, often in the same scene, mm-hmm. quite honestly. Like at the end of the wedding, I'm not going to give any of this away, but how did you find that balance, that tone of the comic and the tragic?
You know, I never direct my actors towards the comedy. I always feel that, like, what's most important is my actors are what grounds the scene, the performances. And so I direct them towards what's real. And for example, there's a very emotional scene with a cousin, and he actually got very, very drunk in real life. He's like, in order to do the scene, I'm going to go drink. I was like, all right, great, go for it. And then he came to me and he's like, director, are we ready to shoot yet? Because I'm ready. I'm ready. I was like, just hold it. We're not ready yet. We're not ready. So for him, it was very real. He also is very close with his grandmother, that actor. And so that's great. You know, I have the truthful emotion from the actor, but I love to create a situation where the situational comedy shows you the absurdity, mm-hmm. While at the same time you're still maintaining empathy for the character that's in the scene.
Yeah, that's interesting you say that. It's almost like you said you didn't direct him toward the comedy, but it's just inherently funny.
Yeah.
In some kind of way. So this is your second feature. Why did this story feel like the next right one to tell?
Yeah, like I was saying before, my first movie was a
Posthumous was the name.
Yes, mm-hmm. Posthumous was a screwball romantic comedy, and this story is also a screwball of sorts, and I wanted to see if I could capture what I love about screwballs, but in a way that was also authentic to life and wasn't necessarily boxed in by a specific genre, but just to see how there are screwball situations everywhere in our lives and be able to balance sort of the joy and the pathos, because I think that in life, joy and grief are so closely knit, and that was the territory that I wanted to explore.
The film did premiere at Sundance this year. A lot of praise for Awkwafina's performance as Billy. And people found a connection to the story in very profound ways. Here is Awkwafina. This is during the Sundance Film Festival, sharing some of the responses she heard from the film.
There were a couple people that came up to me also with tears in their eyes hours after the movie saying, like, we just did this to my grandpa. I just came back from China. I just buried my grandma. And these people, like, they can't hold in their emotions, and it resonates with them in such a strong, like, deep way. You know, movies like this need to exist. And it's like, no matter what, how broad the story goes, I mean, it resonates for sure.
How's your family responded? I mean, they are the basis for this.
I think they're just really proud that that I made it, and also that people are responding to it, because I remember when I was working on the film and the script, and at one point I had my dad read it, and he's like, yeah, this is what happened, but is this interesting? You think, why would anyone give you money to make this, you know? And it was so moving, because to him, it's just every day, and he's a common, you know, person, and he doesn't feel like he's worthy of the screen, of the big screen, you know? And my great aunt, who plays herself in the movie, felt that same way when I wanted to cast her, and she kept saying, but what if my face ruins your movie, mm-hmm. and I have a fat face, and, you know, kind of the self-deprecating humor, and I wanted to show her that she is worthy of a big screen, and she is a movie star in her own right. And so that's really exciting that something so simple as one family story can resonate, because this family is all of our families and their grief is all of our grief.
Well, Lulu Wang, congratulations.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Lulu Wang's film The Farewell opens in theaters in July. She also got a great distribution deal from the sounds of it at Sundance. You can see her film and others at the Atlanta Film Festival. It's running through April 14th. There's more information, including a trailer for The Farewell, at gbbnews.org. Well, that is our show for today. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, LaRaven Taylor, and Amelia Brock. We always love to hear from you. We're on Facebook and we're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can email us at onsecondthought@gpb.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for spending some time with us. This is On Second Thought.